Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de la región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Comprensión de textos orales. Nivel C1. Convocatoria, junio 2019.
A few months ago, with very little fanfare, a small new town opened to the public about 25 miles from the centre of London. The place provided an encouraging spurt of economic growth for the area, and it was swiftly populated by a thriving local community, unhindered, it seemed, by social and political divisiveness. Unusually for a new town, the buildings lacked any sense of architectural unity. An Art Deco vacuum cleaner factory stood near to an 18th-century French-style town hall, while the new train station had a 1930s modernist look. Elsewhere, traditional business was booming, and there was little evidence of the destructive creep of the digital economy. The butcher was doing good trade, as was the greengrocer, and the people walking around the shops didn't appear to be addicted to their phones. It looked like a model village, not least because it was a model village. Modern happiness such as this comes at a price and a scale. In this case, the scale is usually 1 to 12 or 1 to 18, and the price £11 for adults and £6.60 for children. The buildings are a new addition to Beaconscote Model Village in Beaconsfield, Buckinghamshire, which next year celebrates its 90th birthday. Many visitors come for the sense of order and control the model village brings to a chaotic life. The schools are decent, the church is full, and the blaze that regularly engulfs a thatched roof in the middle of town is always dealt with swiftly by the fire brigade. In a way that is both wonderful and unnerving, everything appears to be happening at the very moment we arrive. We are just in time for the chimpanzees' tea party. The cricket match on the green is only now reaching its nail-biting climax, and we are powerless to resist the terrible puns on the shop fronts. Chris P. Lettuce, the greengrocer, Sam and Ella, the butcher, Anne Ecdote, the bookshop. Beaconscote is the oldest continuously open miniature village in the world. Almost 16 million people have visited since 1929, and about 15,000 call in each month. In an age of Netflix, Fortnite and artificial intelligence, we may regard it as remarkable that such a thing has not only endured, but thrived and even expanded. How can one possibly explain the appeal? Nostalgia, certainly. But there are numerous bigger, shinier miniature worlds that Beaconscote has inspired. What about them? Is there something else at play? Something utopian, perhaps? Or something darker for our troubled and unstable times? Miniature kingdoms usually have miniature beginnings. No one can say for sure just how Beaconscott came to be or what its founder intended. The most satisfying story begins with a housebound miniature railway that grew so big a wife reached for the rolling pin. Either it went or she did. The husband, a man named Roland Robert Callingham, a successful accountant, found a third way and in 1927 laid tracks outside to colonise the garden. The village grew around the railway but soon became an obsession. After the standard railway buildings came a castle and a church and miniature lawns, followed by the shops and the population to inhabit them. Callingham did some construction himself and some with assistance from his gardener and other local modellers, but it was a private pastime. And it only became an attraction after friends suggested that on occasional weekends the public should be allowed in too. And so Beaconscott opened to all in 1931, and what was a quaint local novelty attracted national press coverage and then royalty. Its name is a composite of Beaconsfield and Ascot. A few months ago, with very little fanfare, a small new town opened to the public about 25 miles from the centre of London. The place provided an encouraging spurt of economic growth for the area, and it was swiftly populated by a thriving local community, unhindered, it seemed, by social and political divisiveness. Unusually for a new town, the buildings lacked any sense of architectural unity. An Art Deco vacuum cleaner factory stood near to an 18th-century French-style town hall, while the new train station had a 1930s modernist look. Elsewhere, traditional business was booming, and there was little evidence of the destructive creep of the digital economy. The butcher was doing good trade, as was the greengrocer, and the people walking around the shops didn't appear to be addicted to their phones. It looked like a model village, not least because it was a model village. Modern happiness such as this comes at a price and a scale. In this case, the scale is usually 1 to 12 or 1 to 18, and the price £11 for adults and £6.60 for children. The buildings are a new addition to Beaconscott Model Village in Beaconsfield, Buckinghamshire, which next year celebrates its 90th birthday. Many visitors come for the sense of order and control the model village brings to a chaotic life. The schools are decent, the church is full, and the blaze that regularly engulfs a thatched roof in the middle of town is always dealt with swiftly by the fire brigade. In a way that is both wonderful and unnerving, everything appears to be happening at the very moment we arrive. We are just in time for the chimpanzees' tea party. The cricket match on the green is only now reaching its nail-biting climax, and we are powerless to resist the terrible puns on the shop fronts. Chris P. Lettuce, the greengrocer, Sam and Ella, the butcher, Anne Ecdote, the bookshop. Beaconscott is the oldest continuously open miniature village in the world. Almost 16 million people have visited since 1929, and about 15,000 call in each month. In an age of Netflix, Fortnite and artificial intelligence, we may regard it as remarkable that such a thing has not only endured, but thrived and even expanded. How can one possibly explain the appeal? Nostalgia, certainly. But there are numerous bigger, shinier miniature worlds that Beaconscott has inspired. What about them? Is there something else at play? Something utopian, perhaps? Or something darker for our troubled and unstable times? Miniature kingdoms usually have miniature beginnings. No one can say for sure just how Beaconscott came to be or what its founder intended. The most satisfying story begins with a housebound miniature railway that grew so big a wife reached for the rolling pin. Either it went or she did. The husband, a man named Roland Robert Callingham, a successful accountant, found a third way and in 1927 laid tracks outside to colonise the garden. The village grew around the railway but soon became an obsession. After the standard railway buildings came a castle and a church and miniature lawns, followed by the shops and the population to inhabit them. Callingham did some construction himself and some with assistance from his gardener and other local modellers, but it was a private pastime, and it only became an attraction after friends suggested that on occasional weekends the public should be allowed in too. And so Beaconscott opened to all in 1931, and what was a quaint local novelty attracted national press coverage and then royalty. Its name is a composite of Beaconsfield and Ascot.
You've been out of the White House for 662
days. Oh, my gosh.
Days. Whoa. How's it going?
It's going okay.
I want people to get a sense, Michelle, of your life because...
Yeah. My life now?
Your life now. In that first day, it's one of those rare moments. I call it Toastgate, for lack of a better thing. Toastgate.
This is how I open up the book.
Yes.
It's sort of the life that I was living months after we had moved out of the White House. I was alone for the first time in a long time because for 8 years prior to that, I had lived a life where I was always with somebody. There was always a constant presence in the White House. But that day, Barack was traveling, Malia was in college, Sasha was somewhere doing something.
Yeah.
And it was just me and Beau and Sonny, my dogs. And I did what I didn't do for 8 years, which was open up my own cupboard, pull out some bread, and make some cheese toast.
Did you remember how to do that?
I remember. But I still had cheese toast skills.
Throughout the book, there is a lot of, am I good enough? You're told by a school counselor you're not Princeton material. Why didn't that not destroy you at the time?
Well, because fortunately, it was the direct opposite of everything I'd ever been told about myself. I had grown up with love and support and encouragement and high expectations. But here I walked into this room with a woman who really didn't know me because it was a big high school, and she had to make a quick assessment. And her assessment could have been, and I don't know, was grade point average. Yeah, you're a good student. You know, your scores are good. You're black. You're here in this public school. Maybe you're stretching. She didn't even know my brother went to Princeton. She didn't ask me any questions.
Anything about it. Yeah.
She didn't try to figure me out. She just decided that the dream I presented was wrong. But let me tell you, we could probably go into any room of black women or people of color or people who grew up in poor communities or rural communities, and you'd ask them, has anybody ever told you you couldn't? And everyone would raise their hand.
You get to Princeton, and one of the first things you notice is they're not smarter than me.
Mm-hmm. So now I'm expecting brilliance, genius. And then what I discover is, wow, there's a lot of arbitrariness to this stuff, you know, because while a lot of students are sort of criticized, there's a debate about affirmative action when it comes to race. What I point out is that I got to Princeton, I realized there's all kinds of affirmative action that goes on. There are kids who get in because they're athletes. There are kids who get in because there's a legacy. It's just that race stands out. But it was important for me to see that.
Are you tired of the way the country is going? Are you mad enough?
Did you feel you were judged differently? Because you write in the book, your grace would have to be earned.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that you felt you could not stumble.
Yeah. Well, I had experienced that over the course of the campaign. I mean, I write in chapter 17, that chapter was probably one of the hardest for me to write, and it's the hardest still for me to read, because it goes over a painful time in the campaign when I thought I was doing great, telling my story, sharing it honestly, but my whole persona was distorted. This was the time I was called an angry black woman. I was called Obama's baby's mama. I was called someone who didn't love her country. And it's important for me to paint all that because people don't remember that. They see Michelle Obama.
Yeah.
Now, especially young girls, and they were too young to know that part of my journey.
You've been out of the White House for 662
days. Oh, my gosh.
Days. Whoa. How's it going?
It's going okay.
I want people to get a sense, mm-hmm. Michelle, of your life because...
Yeah. My life now?
Your life now. In that mm-hmm. first day,
yeah.
It's one of those rare moments. I call it Toastgate,
yes.
For lack of a better thing. Toastgate.
This is how I open up the book.
Yes.
It's sort of the life that I was living months after we had moved out of the White House. I was alone for the first time in a long time because for 8 years prior to that, I had lived a life where I was always with somebody. There was always a constant presence in the White House. But that day, Barack was traveling, Malia was in college, Sasha was somewhere doing something.
Yeah.
And it was just me and Beau and Sonny, my dogs. And I did what I didn't do for 8 years, which was open up my own cupboard, pull out some bread, and make some cheese toast.
Did you remember how to do that?
I remember.
Yeah.
But I still had cheese toast skills.
Throughout the book, there is a lot of, am I good enough?
Mm.
You're told by a school counselor you're not Princeton material. Why didn't that not destroy you at the time?
Well, because fortunately, it was the direct opposite of everything I'd ever been told about myself. I had grown up with love and support and encouragement and high expectations. But here I walked into this room with a woman who really didn't know me because it was a big high school, and she had to make a quick assessment. And her assessment could have been, and I don't know, was grade point average. Yeah, you're a good student. You know, your scores are good. You're black. You're here in this public school. Maybe you're stretching. She didn't even know my brother went to Princeton. She didn't ask me any questions.
Anything about it. Yeah.
She didn't try to figure me out. She just decided that the dream I presented was wrong. But let me tell you, we could probably go into any room of black women or people of color or people who grew up in poor communities or rural communities, and you'd ask them, has anybody ever told you you couldn't? And everyone would raise their hand.
You get to Princeton, and one of the first things you notice is they're not smarter than me.
Mm-hmm. So now I'm expecting brilliance, genius. And then what I discover is, wow, there's a lot of arbitrariness to this stuff, you know, because while a lot of students are sort of criticized, there's a debate about affirmative action when it comes to race. What I point out is that I got to Princeton, I realized there's all kinds of affirmative action that goes on. There are kids who get in because they're athletes. There are kids who get in because there's a legacy. It's just that race stands out. But it was important for me to see that.
Are you tired of the way the country is going? Are you mad enough?
Did you feel you were judged differently? Because you write in the book, your grace would have to be earned.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that you felt you could not stumble.
Yeah. Well, I had experienced that over the course of the campaign. I mean, I write in chapter 17. That chapter was probably one of the hardest for me to write, and it's the hardest still for me to read, because it goes over a painful time in the campaign when I thought I was doing great, telling my story, sharing it honestly, but my whole persona was distorted. This was the time I was called an angry black woman. I was called Obama's baby's mama. I was called someone who didn't love her country. And it's important for me to paint all that, because people don't remember that. They see Michelle Obama.
Yeah.
Now, especially young girls, and they were too young to know that part of my journey.
I think it's a fantastic play about now in terms of the relationship that we have to technology and scientific advancement. But it's very accessible, it's very funny, it's a very moving story. The play begins with a man who, as he calls it, is past his middle years, who wants to leave a legacy, he wants to do something big. He knows that what he's doing is going to be absolutely epic and change the world. He's driven to do it.
He's a rather self-satisfied, self-indulgent, ambitious genius. He's a complete obsessive. You know, his science and his quest for the truth, it's not even a quest for the truth. He knows the truth. He recognizes that these things are facts. And a few other people recognize it too, and it doesn't suit them, so they pretend they're not.
And yet the first example you see in the play is him proving something to Andrea, the little boy, with an apple and a pencil. And it's a beautiful collision between the epic and the personal that makes the play so brilliant.
You never feel at any point that you're orating or you're presenting a point. You're always talking, you know, through the humanity of the characters. I mean, that's what Brecht has really done in the journey of writing it. It's a play that champions humanity. And Galileo, at the end of the play, realizes that he can't go down his single track on the road to the truth, even though that's what it is. Without taking into account its effect on other people.
Although it's a play about science, you've got at the centre a character who wants to make science for the people, for everyone to be able to love and enjoy. And so he spends a lot of the play being very inspirational about how science is part of our everyday life.
It does seem to me at the moment that science is in the air. People are more and more interested in it through television and so on, Brian Cox's series. And people are encouraged to go out, as Galileo keeps telling them to do, and look at the sky and see how it works themselves. I've got a telescope at home. And, you know, once you start doing that, you really get hooked because it is quite extraordinary. And the thing that's extraordinary about it, it's true about the sky, it's always changing. And that's also one of the themes of the play.
We think of our age as being one of a very fast technological change, and it is. But the Renaissance period was similar in terms of the rate of technological change. And part of the issues that we face are that the technology and the scientific discoveries that we have are much further ahead than we're socially willing to change. And that is constantly the battle. So, you know, it's Facebook and privacy at the most banal. It rears its head in genetics, it rears its head in climate change, it rears its head in technology. So the play has become very current.
It's just great. It makes you think about your place in the universe and also about infinite possibilities.
I think it's a fantastic play about now, in terms of the relationship that we have to technology and scientific advancement. But it's very accessible, it's very funny, it's a very moving story. The play begins with a man who, as he calls it, is past his middle years, who wants to leave a legacy, he wants to do something big. He knows that what he's doing is going to be absolutely epic and change the world. He's driven to do it.
He's a rather self-satisfied, self-indulgent, ambitious genius. He's a complete obsessive. You know, his science and his quest for the truth, it's not even a quest for the truth. He knows the truth. He recognizes that these things are facts. And a few other people recognize it too, and it doesn't suit them, so they pretend they're not.
And yet the first example you see in the play is him proving something to Andrea, the little boy, with an apple and a pencil. And it's a beautiful collision between the epic and the personal that makes the play so brilliant.
You never feel at any point that you're orating or you're presenting a point. You're always talking, you know, through the humanity of the characters. I mean, that's what Brecht has really done in the journey of writing it. It's a play that champions humanity. And Galileo, at the end of the play, realizes that he can't go down his single track on the road to the truth, even though that's what it is. without taking into account its effect on other people.
Although it's a play about science, you've got at the centre a character who wants to make science for the people, for everyone to be able to love and enjoy. And so he spends a lot of the play being very inspirational about how science is part of our everyday life.
It does seem to me at the moment that science is in the air. People are more and more interested in it through television and so on, Brian Cox's series. And people are encouraged to go out, as Galileo keeps telling them to do, and look at the sky and see how it works themselves. Yeah, I've got a telescope at home. Once you start doing that, you really get hooked because it is quite extraordinary. And the thing that's extraordinary about it, it's true about the sky, it's always changing. And that's also one of the themes of the play.
We think of our age as being one of a very fast technological change, and it is. But the Renaissance period was similar in terms of the rate of technological change. And part of the issues that we face are that the technology and the scientific discoveries that we have are much further ahead than we're socially willing to change. And that is constantly the battle. So, it's Facebook and privacy at the most banal. It rears its head in genetic, it rears its head in climate change, it rears its head in technology. So the play has become very current.
It's just great. It makes you think about your place in the universe and also about infinite possibilities.
Fin de la prueba.